Not enough rain in Central America has led to a big global problem.
It's not just that you can't go on a water ski holiday. You have an issue with a major artery in trade.
We're talking the Panama Canal, where drought means cargo ships can't get through at the moment. The wait could last for weeks. Also today, there's a new prime minister in Thailand, but it's not the guy who actually won the most recent national election.
Thailand has entered this really surreal phase. It's unclear who is really going to be calling the shots.
I'm Marco Werman, and the officials at the International Chess Federation have decided that trans women will not be allowed to compete in chess competitions exclusively for women. This grandmaster says it doesn't make sense.
These rules seem to be mean. Like, I mean, it really comes down to that, and I think that a lot of times it's just nasty.
All that today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. We start with some news about a traffic jam at sea. It's not your average snarl. This one can actually be seen from space and could impact lots of people around the globe. Imagine some 200 container ships stuck outside of the Panama Canal. They're waiting their turn to pass through, but getting to the front of the line at the moment could take weeks. To be clear, this is not normal. There's currently a problem with the system of locks that fill with water and carry cargo ships across. Matt Vick is keeping a close eye on the situation. He's a trade and customs specialist at the Institute of Export and International Trade in the UK. Matt, what happened here?
Well, yes, it certainly does put the rush hour commute into perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a bit of an issue with a few places in the world, really. We have these key arteries for trade, and there's really a few notable ones we can think of. Panama is one. We've got the Suez Canal. You've got ones like the English Channel. So whenever a blockage happens in one of these areas, it has big impacts and big ramifications. So in the particular case of the canal, it's, as you've mentioned, an issue with the lock. So for anybody that isn't sure how the canal works, it's sort of like a big escalator, really. Let's say you want to transit from the Pacific side to the Caribbean side. Then what will happen is a ship will come up to the first lock. That will be level with seawater. And that first lock will then raise up. A second lock will then go level with the first. The ship will move across to the second lock, where it will keep going up incrementally until it reaches the peak. Once it's at the peak, it will start the descent in the same way.
Got it.
Now, the problem really is that the water for raising and lowering the locks is from a source from rivers and lakes in the area in the Panama region. And what's happened is there's been a massive drought. So far as we can tell from the recorded history that we've got, it might be the hottest 1 or 2 years ever. And that has meant very little rainfall. It's also meant an evaporation problem. So the water that they're trying to use to level the canal just isn't there in the same volume that it is normally.
So, Matt, are you saying that there isn't enough water? Is that an aggravation from climate change?
It could be at least in part caused by this. And for that reason, anybody that's really worried about climate change, this is kind of one of those examples of what the things that happen when something like a drought occurs. It's not just that food production stops and you can't go on a water ski holiday. You have an issue with a major artery in trade.
Now, if you're on a schedule, like I imagine many of these ships are, what are your options? Just wait and deal with the losses?
Yeah, this is really one of the difficult decisions a lot of the shipping companies are going to be wrangling with. The Panama Canal is massive for both regional, so the local movement, and much larger international movements. So, for instance, all the way from East Asia. If you're in this situation, then you're facing the prospect of delays of about 3 weeks. The big problem we've got is a large number of these 200 ships that are blocked are bulk ships, so things like grain and wheat and other food like that. It's also oil and gas.
Yeah.
So these are two pretty essential commodity areas.
Let's recall that the Panama Canal was constructed precisely to save time and money, allowing ships to avoid that long ride down to the bottom of South America and turning back north at Cape Horn.
Yep.
How big an effect could this have on the global economy?
It's really one of those key arteries for international trade just across the board. And as you mentioned, when we talk about the shipping companies and why this is such a difficult situation, yes, in theory, they have alternatives. They could route either overland. They could try and shift it onto, for example, rail networks and get it across the peninsula that way. But there can be issues with documentation and not to mention cost and availability of the service there. The other thing, as you mentioned, is you transit all the way past South America, all the way past Brazil and so on. That adds weeks and potentially thousands of dollars in costs delays and issues like this can cause a scarcity of supply. That then drives costs up. And that's also going to have to be passed on, most likely, unfortunately, to the end consumer.
Patience, please, you ships out there waiting to get into the Panama Canal. Matt Vick is with the Institute of Export and International Trade in the United Kingdom. Matt, thanks very much for your insight.
Perfect. Thanks very much, Marco, and thanks for having me on. It's been great to talk to you.
Thailand has a new prime minister. Sethat Thawisin is from a party known for riling up the country's powerful military. Now, the army in Thailand dominates the courts and much of the country's parliament and is notorious for sabotaging anyone threatening its control. So why would Thailand's army let a rival run the country? The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen joins us from Bangkok. Patrick, who is the new Thai prime minister and how did he secure the job?
Sethat is a businessman. He's actually a bit new to politics. 61 years old, he went to college in California. But honestly, Marco, he as an individual is less interesting and less important than the political machine that he belongs to, and that's a party called Pheutai, which means for Thai people. This party's whole brand is anti-military. And not surprisingly, when they do win elections, the military comes in and throws them out. So what's happening now is quite shocking. Military figures have lined up behind Pheutai. These arch enemies are coming together, and there will be a new government that is led by Pheutai, led by Mr. Sethat as the head of the party, heading up this strange coalition with pro-military parties, including former generals who have plotted coups against them.
So it's a bit of a complex story, Patrick, this new prime minister and this coalition. Remind us why this is happening when Thailand's election was more than 3 months ago.
Yeah, the election was 3 months ago, and Pheutai, this party, did not win that election. They actually came in second. In a standard democracy, the winner of that election would be already running the country, right? But Thailand's military looked at the winning party and said, no way, they are too radical. That party is called the Move Forward Party. They're young, they're feisty, and they want to tear down the status quo completely, totally remove the army from political meddling. So the army, using the courts and other means, blocked them, clearly terrified that voters voted for such a progressive overhaul of Thailand. So then the military looked to their traditional rivals, which is Pheutai, and said they're the lesser of two evils, and it has taken 3 months for these rivals to hammer out a deal. Pheutai, shockingly, is just going along with this, figuring that in Thailand, you either make peace with the military or you're doomed.
Wow. So not only does Thailand have a new prime minister, big news out of Thailand today, a former prime minister returned to the country from exile. What's that all about?
Yeah, that former prime minister is Thaksin Shinawat, and nobody looms over Thai politics quite like Thaksin. He is the creator and godfather of this Pheutai political machine. He is a billionaire, but he has a big working class following because he will say, I'm the one who can take on these army elites. And traditionally, the army hates Thaksin. They toppled him in a coup. They hit him with corruption charges. That's why he fled Thailand 15 years ago, basing himself in Dubai. Most people thought he would never return to the country. But today, he flew into Bangkok on his private jet, and there were thousands of supporters there waiting for him. So they're chanting, Thaksin, fight, fight. And I was there at the airport where some of his supporters got really emotional. That's a woman named Kim Jira Ratana Shinawat. She's a day laborer, and you can hear that she's crying, telling me that today is a brand new day for Thai people. He has come to return our happiness. That's the kind of devotion Thaksin can inspire.
So, Patrick, a final question. Will there be a role for Thaksin to play in the new government?
That is the question everybody has. Right now, he's actually in prison. So after waving to supporters at the airport, he went to court and got booked into prison to face all those corruption charges that he left behind. He's facing 8 years. So the new prime minister, Sethat, is a disciple of Thaksin. So everyone's wondering, can Thaksin just tell him what to do? Will Thaksin run the government as a puppet master from prison? Some of his supporters say, we hope so. And the problem for Thaksin now and his whole party is that to get back to power, they have sacrificed their whole identity. They've joined with the military that tried to destroy them. And Thaksin does have his core fans, as you heard, but most voters, they want the military to have less power. So Thailand has entered this really surreal phase. It's unclear who is really going to be calling the shots, the new Prime Minister Setha or Thaksin from behind the scenes or behind bars.
The World's Patrick Nguyen is based in Bangkok. Patrick, thanks as always.
Thanks, Marco.
Canada's government is at odds with big tech right now. The source of the dispute is the country's new media law. It requires tech companies like Meta and Google to pay news publishers in Canada for content they produce. Meta has responded by cutting access to news on Facebook and Instagram for Canadian users, and that's having an impact on Canadians trying to get information about major wildfires. Ahmed Alrawi is an associate professor of news, social media, and public communication with the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia.
So the Canadian government is asking social media sites to pay back some money to news organizations because they are the content creators. Meta, as well as Google, objected to that and decided to block all news content from Google, the search site, and also from Meta, Facebook, including Instagram. And that's the challenge that we have today in Canada.
So understanding that new law you mentioned is crucial. But first, let me ask you what Meta is saying about this accusation that they're banning news from Canadian readers.
This is a blame game, right? So the Canadian government is blaming social media, and social media is also blaming the Canadian government for exaggerating or for taking some kind of, somehow like they framed it as unrealistic measures to penalize social media sites. So each one is blaming the other. And of course, in the end, Canadians, the regular users, will be definitely impacted by these developments.
So let's go to this law. Explain, prior to this law passing this month, how a company like Meta typically acquires content from Canadian media.
After social media, everything changed, as you know. So news organizations started to increasingly rely on social media sites to spread their news. So on the one hand, it worked really well for news organizations. On the other hand, it also pulled a lot of advertisers from the news organizations themselves. What happened in the end was that local journalism got directly impacted. By the way, not only in Canada, but this also applies to the US and to many other countries in the world. Many news organizations, especially in rural areas, had to close down because of the lack of advertising revenue. And that's because these social media sites got all the revenues, billions of dollars we're talking here.
So with this new law prescribing payment to local media, how did Meta and Google initially react?
They reacted very fast, saying, no way, we will not pay you anything. We will not compensate. And they were, both of them, claiming that they did a lot of service and they offered a lot of help to news organizations. They might have, you know, paid a few millions, but they actually profited billions in return. So I think they haven't done enough. And I believe also that their actions were meant to send a clear message to other countries lest they follow Canada's lead, because they were probably concerned that they would lose more money and more revenue in other places.
So meantime, and briefly, how are Canadians getting news about these fires right now?
Different sources. So maybe traditional media like radio here seems to be very much effective, which is great, especially that a lot of people on the move have the radios on in their cars. So that's great. Also, text messages, face-to-face, you know, interpersonal, word of mouth. I also noticed that CBC, is like our own public service broadcaster, has activated the light service. So even if you have a weak internet connection, you will be able to get the news from CBC app. I think this is a great thing, especially if you are on the move and there are fires around you.
Ahmed Alrawi is a professor at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. These are tough times for the southern African nation of Zimbabwe. It's got one of the highest rates of inflation on earth, and its politics are marred by violence and repression, according to human rights groups. That is the context for Zimbabweans on the eve of a presidential election there. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
As election day neared, Zimbabweans poured into last-minute campaign events where candidates made their final pitches at colorful and musical rallies. 80-year-old incumbent President Emmerson Mnangagwa said in a recent campaign speech that he is confident he and his ruling ZANU-PF party will win.
We are determined to lift more and more of our people out of poverty into higher quality of life.
The president says he and his party have improved life in the country. But in reality, the Zimbabwe of today is a hard place to live in. Justina Mukoko is with the NGO Zimbabwe Peace Project.
It's a very difficult situation where most people live on a dollar or less a day.
President Mnangagwa rose to power in 2017 after helping unseat his longtime ally, dictator Robert Mugabe. He was then elected in 2018 and promised to improve life for Zimbabweans, but that hasn't happened. And Mokoko says Mnangagwa and his party have continued to use the same repressive tactics as in the past.
When the coup happened, it was that same system that took over from Mugabe. So it's nothing new to them.
Mukoko says there is no evidence that the president is committed to free and fair elections. His main challenger in this race is Nelson Chamisa, a former minister of information who leads the opposition party Citizens Coalition for Change. Chamisa is running on a promise of change, improving the economy, ending corruption and political violence, and strengthening democracy. He says he wants to bring the nation together.
We will say one people, one nation,
one vision.
But Chamisa faces steep challenges. While he might be popular in urban areas, the ruling party still dominates in the rural parts of the country, says Alexander Rosero, professor at Africa University in eastern Zimbabwe.
Because, by the way, it was in the rural areas that the liberation war was fought and not in the urban center.
ZANU-PF led the long struggle against white minority rule in Zimbabwe before the country finally achieved independence about 40 years ago. It's that history that Mnangagwa keeps returning to in his campaign speeches, especially in the face of criticism.
So no one should assume any role to teach us democracy, because we fought for it, because we acquired it ourselves.
But ZANU-PF has been anything but democratic. Human rights groups say they are worried that political violence could stop people from voting freely. The results of the presidential election are expected to be announced within 5 days. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Zimbabwe could play a key role in the transition to a clean energy infrastructure. It's home to Africa's largest reserves of lithium, a key element for solar panels and electric car batteries. Not surprisingly, Zimbabwe wants to make money off its lithium, not just have it dug up and carted away. So the government put new rules in place for foreign investors. They could be advantageous for China. William Tobin is with the Global Energy Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Will, what are Zimbabwe's new rules for lithium exports?
Zimbabwe's new rules are what they refer to as the Base Minerals Export Control Act. It's essentially a rule designed to stop the country from losing money that could otherwise be gained and ultimately generate revenue for the country based off of what is referred to as beneficiating lithium resource. When you think about the value chain for producing lithium, you start at the mine, right? And you start with ore, but that ore has to be processed from a very unconcentrated, basically, pile of dirt into something that has economic value, which is much more concentrated. And Zimbabwe is trying to increase the amount of that activity, which is occurring in country, and basically increase the economic value of the lithium that they can export.
It seems, though, that China is one foreign investor that could benefit from this. So is China going to attempt to process lithium inside Zimbabwe?
It does seem that way, and that's really occurring for two reasons. The mere fact that China has been a first mover in investing in Zimbabwe's lithium industry. So they're already there. They have the relationships. They have the infrastructure. They've actually spent more than $1 billion over the past 2 years in acquiring and developing lithium projects in the country. As a result of that, they've been in a place where they can adjust and fairly quickly to these new export control requirements that Zimbabwe has put in place. And that leads me to the second reason why they're well positioned to do this, and that's the mere fact that Chinese mining firms have the ability to move quickly and essentially to operate in environments where Western mining firms may not be comfortable. In this case, Zimbabwe, which is under a series of sanctions from both the U.S. and Europe and a few other countries.
How invested is China already in lithium mining in Zimbabwe? I mean, does it already have processing plants there?
From what I can tell, China actually has three companies that have been successful in bringing processing plants off the ground in Zimbabwe. The first is Shengxin Lithium, the second is Sinomine Resource, and the third is Huayu. So Huayu has invested in a mine in Zimbabwe called Arcadia. They bought it in April 2022, and in only a span of 9 months, they were able to construct and begin operating a lithium processing plant, which basically takes the raw ore from the ground and converts it into a more concentrated form called spodumene.
Hmm. Are there any other countries in a position to compete with China for access to Zimbabwe's lithium, or is China's scale just so large that it pretty much blocks out any competitors?
So I think that we have to view this within the context of the Belt and Road Initiative.
China's big infrastructure project.
Exactly. And of course, this big infrastructure investment project has had some strategic, perhaps some geopolitical motivations for China. But I think these days, China is also using it basically as a tool to feed its domestic battery manufacturing and mineral processing industries. Even though these Chinese firms are going to process the ore in Zimbabwe, it has to be processed again in China to make it battery grade for lithium ion batteries. So I think that China really has a strong motivation to be a leader in investing in Zimbabwe's resources so that it can intake those resources for its own industry. And that really makes it pretty difficult to compete with because we just don't have those industries yet in the US or Europe or other countries of the like.
So if China ends up by controlling lithium exports from Zimbabwe, is there a risk that China will be dominant in the making of batteries and solar panels? Or is there just enough lithium in other parts of the globe for other economies?
So there is enough lithium, but I would say that as of right now, China, of course, already is dominant in this lithium value chain. They have about 58% of lithium processing globally. And unfortunately, we're not really seeing an indication that that's going to change anytime soon, although there are some incentives, one of them being the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, which is a policy we put in place here in the United States designed to incentivize mineral processing domestically.
William Tobin is the Assistant Director at the Global Energy Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Will, thank you very much.
Marco, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
More news and stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. When the People's Liberation Army marched into Beijing, victorious in 1949, Isabel Crook was there.
Then came the incoming cavalry, which was very exciting. It was the most joyful event I think I've ever watched.
We remember one of the few foreigners at the birth of the People's Republic of China, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today in South Africa, the BRICS summit got into full swing. BRICS, referring to that coalition of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They've been meeting annually for more than a decade. Collectively, the five nations represent well over a third of the world's population, along with a growing share of the global economy. But at this summit, BRICS leaders are talking about the possibility of adding new members. The list of interested countries is a long one. Joining us to discuss the implications of this international gathering in Johannesburg is Parag Carmody. He's a professor at Trinity College, Dublin. In a nutshell, Parag, what do the BRICS countries represent? What's their mission statement, if you will?
So their mission statement is really to try and rebalance the world order. So they are countries which feel that the current world order is overly dominated by the United States and the West, and that there needs to be a rebalancing to take the interests and voices of developing countries or the global South more into account.
So China has portrayed the BRICS nations as a counterweight to the G7, but do they have the same economic clout?
It partly depends on how you measure it. So in US dollar terms, and the US dollar is still by far the world's most important currency. In US dollar terms, the G7, the biggest industrial democracies in the world outside of India, they are in dollar terms more important. But if you look at what economists call purchasing power parity terms, that is what Chinese money will buy in China or what Indian money will buy in India, then actually the BRICS is now bigger. So it depends on how you look at it, but the claim is made that the BRICS nations are now more important economically than the G7.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about at this BRICS summit, there's this kind of de-dollarization coalition that is, quote, aiming to reduce the reliance on the U.S. dollar and promote the use of national currencies in international trade. What's the story here? What are they talking about there at the summit?
So the U.S. dollar, as I mentioned, is the world's dominant currency. So it accounts for about 40% of transactions in world trade. The euro makes up about 40% as well. If you look at foreign exchange transactions, the dollar accounts for well over 80% of all foreign exchange trades. And we can go through other metrics as well. And basically, one of the things that these countries object to, there's a few things they object to. First of all, the US can print money and buy things from China or from India for free, essentially, because other countries want to hold US dollars in their central banks and because they need it to buy oil or other commodities a lot of the time. It means the US gets a bump to its economy of about 8 or 10%, some economists estimate, of things they can buy for free. So some people object to that. The other thing is, because the US dollar is so used in international transactions, that it means that the US can bring sanctions to bear in a way that other countries simply can't. So if you look at what's happened with Russia, for example, the US, by virtue of its financial power, has been able to sanction Russia, Russian banks, the Russian central bank, in a way that just wouldn't be possible otherwise. And some countries resent that ability of the United States to be able to exercise that kind of financial power and to subject them to sanctions. And obviously, this is a very live issue with the conflict in Ukraine and the sanctions on Russia.
How realistic is de-dollarization at this point, do you think?
It's difficult. A major stumbling block is the fact that the Chinese currency is not fully convertible. So it trades within 2% of its midpoint value on a daily basis. And that means that it's not going to be used for financial transactions in the way that the US dollar is, for example. So de-dollarization is happening. Obviously, the euro is now a major reserve currency. And so it's gradual. The de-dollarization of the global economy is a gradual phenomenon. But I think there are major obstacles to developing a common BRICS currency. And the South Africans have explicitly said that it won't be discussed at this meeting.
So the other notable thing, Parek, at this BRICS summit is that these five BRICS countries could now get new members. I understand that 22 countries have applied for formal membership. What do you make of the prospects of expanding this bloc of nations?
So the different BRICS members have different uses and perceptions of the group. So for Russia and for China, particularly now China, they see it as a potential bulwark or counterweight to the West. Whereas India, Brazil, and South Africa, the three democracies in the group, maintain close relations with the West. And so China is keen in the context of the tensions with the US, the trade wars, and the other things we've been talking about, of building up a base of support in the BRICS. And so they're meant to be keen on enlargement. India is more circumspect about this because, for example, India has just joined the Quad, which is Japan, India, the United States, and Australia. And that's partly to do with Indian concerns around their security and broader security in the Indo-Pacific with an eye to China, obviously, and its rising military, economic, and political power. So the Indians are perhaps less keen, although the Indian foreign minister says that they're coming to this meeting with good intent and an open mind. So we'll wait and see what develops. The more likely scenario, I think, is that the so-called BRICS Plus format will be expanded. And what this is that other countries' leaders from many continents are invited to attend these BRICS meetings and to have meetings with the five BRICS leaders. And also that they'll be encouraged to join some BRICS institutions like the BRICS Development Bank, the new development bank. It already has some members that are non-BRICS, like Egypt, for example. So I think some people talk about a kind of two-tier BRIC structure. Russia says in some of its policy documents that countries like Egypt that are already members of this BRICS bank are in effect already BRIC members.
Parek Carmody is professor in geography at Trinity College Dublin, speaking with us about the BRICS summit in South Africa this week. Parek, thanks very much for taking the time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
A new report out this week paints a grim picture of how Saudi Arabia deals with migrants approaching its borders. Human Rights Watch says that since March of last year, Saudi border guards have killed hundreds of people trying to enter the kingdom from Yemen. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
Men, women, and children walk along the mountainous region between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. These are mostly Ethiopians who have fled the civil war in their country in search of safety. But setting out on this journey, what many of them probably didn't know was that instead of safety, they would be met with gunshots and rockets. These videos have been posted online by the migrants themselves. One shows a group of men struggling to carry a wounded man down a steep slope. They're trekking along what's called the Eastern Route, from the Horn of Africa, across the Gulf of Aden, to Yemen and into Saudi Arabia. In recent years, more women and girls are taking this route.
We've been following this journey. We've been looking at social media posts by Ethiopian migrants and have been in touch with them for some years now.
Bill Freilich heads the Human Rights Watch's Refugee and Migrant Rights Division. He says starting March of last year, they noticed an uptick in the accounts of violence carried out by the Saudi border guards.
There were accounts of really hundreds of people who had been killed through explosive weapons and small arms fire that were directed at these unarmed civilians that were trying to cross the border.
Human Rights Watch interviewed dozens of people who took the journey themselves, as well as families of those who died. They geolocated videos and photos posted by the migrants online, and they looked at satellite images. What emerged, Freilich says, is a picture of systematic abuse by Saudi border guards. He says these are not just a few agents behaving badly. Sarah Leibitson is executive director of Dawn, a human rights NGO in the U.S. She says there has long been a pattern of Saudi security forces shooting at and killing migrants along this route.
But I think this is the first time that we've seen such massive numbers and such truly grotesque and inhumane acts.
Last year, the United Nations raised the issue of the mistreatment of migrants at the border with the Saudis, but they dismissed them. Saudi officials are also calling Monday's report unfounded and not based on reliable sources. Saudi scholar and activist Hala Al-Dosari says wealthy Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia tend to avoid taking in those who are fleeing war and persecution.
Economic concerns is a big thing here. The other thing is political. Those political systems are built on the notion of complete loyalty to the regimes. So opening the door to all refugees, all asylum seekers, might bring in, you know, other political groups, especially from the Muslim Brotherhoods or others who might not be wanted, basically, by those systems.
This is why, she says, the Saudis will offer financial support to displaced people in other countries, but not accept them as refugees. Sarah Leibitson of Dawn says the US, UK, as well as the United Nations must pressure the government of Saudi Arabia to treat those seeking refuge more humanely.
Saudi Arabia could not be getting away with what it's getting away with were it not for such strong, unashamed support from the Biden administration and from the Sunak administration.
Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, has invited the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to visit the UK this fall. The Crown Prince was mostly boycotted by Western nations after the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. That seems to be history now. Human rights advocates say war, unemployment, and drought will continue to push Ethiopians and others to try their luck at the border. This video posted online shows a group of men digging graves close to the trail. Human Rights Watch says they found at least 8 burial sites in the border region. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The governing bodies of international sports have struggled with the question of how transgender athletes compete. Those divisive conversations typically center on the physical edge that athletes might have in competition. Now chess enters the fray. This month, the International Chess Federation decided it would no longer allow transgender women to compete in chess tournaments exclusively for women. The policy was prefaced with a comment that this is an evolving issue for chess. but it did not provide a reason for the policy change. Jennifer Shahadi is a two-time U.S. women's chess champion. She's been vocal in her opposition to the Federation's new policy, barring trans women from women's events.
You know, I don't really understand the rationale myself. I think that transgender women are an important part of our community, and adding this extra hurdle doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense and is really, I think, mean-spirited. I think that's what's so troubling about it.
So prior to this decision, I'm curious, what had been the discussion in the chess world among kind of everybody about transgender women playing in women's only tournaments?
Well, from my perspective, I thought that, you know, people were mostly excited and welcoming to them, because one of the main reasons for women's tournaments is to provide a safe space for players who are often harassed or belittled in open events, which is still the primary way that chess is played. So most of the events that women, transgender players playing are going to be open events. These women's events are like special occasions where they get to enjoy themselves among a smaller group of players who are often like-minded.
So, I mean, if it had happened, what difference would that have made in competition? Is there an advantage?
Well, I think what I'm saying is that I don't really think there's a different way of playing chess between like women and men, except for the fact that oftentimes women are not as encouraged as men. They don't have the same community as men. Sometimes they're harassed and abused. I mean, the interesting thing is that this ban kind of came at a very weird time where chess is really experiencing its Me Too movement, with more women coming forward and talking about the ways in which they have been harassed or even assaulted in chess. And so that's really the reason for those women's tournaments in my eyes. These rules seem to be mean. Like, I mean, it really comes down to that. And I think that a lot of times it's just nasty. Like, it's not like, oh, let's make this fair and make sure that we can welcome people. That's why I think, you know, really they should have consulted more transgender players, because I think once you talk to transgender players and see the struggles that they've been through, you can really see more clearly why you would want to welcome them. And when you make the policies without actually talking to those people or knowing those people or being friends with people who are affected by it, like stuff like this happens.
So the Federation, the International Chess Federation, said it would conduct a 2-year review of this policy. It repeatedly stated a need for further analysis that aligns with research evidence. I mean, do you think that a policy review should have been done before making such, you know, what seems like a swift and defining decision?
Well, I'm hoping that all of the, you know, public outrage on this will make them kind of like reverse course and reconsider this. I mean, they should know that this is not something that people are happy with.
So several national chess organizations have come out against the Federation, stating they will still allow trans women to participate in women's competitions. How much impact do these smaller chess organizations hold in the grand scheme of things?
Well, I think it's really important to make that statement. So I saw statements from Germany, from France, from the USA, and from England as well. And I think it just is great that the statements are making it clear that not everybody agrees that this is a good policy. I do want to say there is one very strong transgender female player from France, Yosha Iglesias, who has, you know, spoke out about this quite vocally. And for somebody like her, it actually could impact her directly in that she could like be excluded from championships. But for a lot of people, it's more about the messaging, the meanness, the cruelty of it. And that's why I think these federations setting the record straight is so key.
Jennifer Shahadi is a 2-time U.S. women's chess champion who also holds the International Chess Federation title of Woman Grandmaster. She joined me to talk about the decision made by the International Chess Federations to ban transgender women from participating in international women's chess tournaments. Jennifer Shahadi, thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
We reached out to the International Chess Federation for comment and did not hear back before our broadcast. Folks who follow track and field know Sha'Carri Richardson as an exceptional sprinter. Last night in Budapest, Hungary, the 23-year-old American proved it, winning the 100-meter world championships in record time.
It's an incredible performance from Sha'Carri Richardson. Richardson came through like a rocket in lane 9.
That video from World Athletics showed Richardson pulling ahead at the end and looking stunned at first, then elated by her victory. If you don't follow track, you might only know Richardson, unfortunately, as the athlete who was barred from the Tokyo Olympics 2 years ago after testing positive for marijuana. But for Richardson, don't call it a comeback. She said after the event, "I'm not back, I'm better." Richardson's gold medal 100-meter sprint last night was a blistering 10.65 seconds, setting a new record for the World Championships. Isabel Crook was one of the very few foreigners to witness firsthand the founding of the People's Republic of China. That was in Tiananmen Square, 1949, when Mao Zedong proclaimed the establishment of the People's Republic of China. Isabel Crook was among a small handful of foreign nationals who actually participated in the Communist Party's rural revolution, and along with her husband David, then went on to spend most of their lives in China. Isabel Crook died on Sunday at the age of 107. We caught up with her son Carl at his home in Vermont. Carl, firstly, our condolences to you and your family. Your mother, I mean, she lived over a century, and what a remarkable life.
Yes, she really covered this turbulent period in China.
Yeah, I mean, an epic period of history. Your mother's parents, your grandparents, were Methodist missionaries who met in China. Your mother, Isabel, was born in Chengdu in 1915. What are the sorts of stories she told you about her childhood?
Well, she had a very happy childhood. My grandparents were in China mainly as missionaries to build education, and they helped to found a university in Chengdu, which is still flourishing now. So my mother grew up on a campus, a little bit sheltered from the surrounding society. They were outside the city of Chengdu. It was a pretty chaotic place from 1915 to 1930s was all the warlord period in China. So there were horrendous things going on. There's war, famine, disease. The missionaries were not all spared. I mean, two of her siblings did die as children of disease. So, but yet she had this positive outlook and wanted to perform service.
In 1941, your mother Isabel met your father. He was already a committed member of the British Communist Party. He had volunteered in Spain. They traveled to Britain to get married, and after World War II, they returned to China, and she was there in 1949 when the People's Liberation Army entered Beijing.
We looked all down the street, and it was had people, students, lots of students, all with red triangular flags that they were waving. Then came the incoming cavalry, which was very exciting. It was the most joyful event I think I've ever watched.
What did your mother tell you about that day, Carl?
Well, 49 was the year I was born, and I think she was pregnant with me when she viewed the entry of the People's Liberation Army into Beijing. And then the Civil War sort of ended a few months later, and the People's Republic was established. I was 2 months old then. Yes, yeah, she had great hopes for China. And she, of course, was converted by my father that the revolution was necessary to change China. So I think she was devoted to the cause. And she had already worked in the liberated areas during the Civil War before entering Beijing. Her main interest, it was still rural China and how to improve the lot of the farmers and the rural society and all its problems. And I think she published several important books on the subject matter together with my father. Her devotion was always to the common people, I think, to the lower classes of China, I think. And I think part of it comes from her parents' missionary spirit of service.
So that dedication, it should not surprise us, meant an invitation was extended to your parents to stay in China, but things were not always easy. I mean, during the Cultural Revolution, Chinese authorities locked up your mother for 3 years on her college campus. Your father was accused of spying and was imprisoned for 5 years. How did those experiences change their views of China?
They were treated very roughly at the time, and I think there was some dispirit, I might say. My dad especially was in solitary for 5 years. My mother was pretty much in solitary, but more on campus. Although it shook them, they still were convinced by their colleagues, for the most part, Chinese colleagues in the university, to stay on, although there was plans of leaving China. And I think they did not regret staying, though I must say that those were extremely difficult times, even, you know, for her three sons. We were working in industrial factories at the time, and we did not know their whereabouts.
How old were you?
When they were first taken, I was must have been 17.
And you were working in a factory.
I couldn't leave China either, so I ended up being sent to a farm tool building factory for a time. When my parents came out, we were in a great hurry to leave, and my parents decided they would stay.
Well, 50 years after the founding of the Communist Party in Tiananmen Square comes the dark chapter at Tiananmen Square, the protests in 1989, and your parents brought water to the demonstrators. I mean, they were writing to the People's Daily cautioning against the use of force. They spoke out after the crackdown. They still did not leave the country. Why not?
Basically, China was their home, and they couldn't see living anywhere else at that point. Though things were quite bleak for them at that point. Finally, I think things eased a bit, and the whole subject was treated by the society in overall as not to talk about it, and they accepted that and carried on. And I think they were very pleased in the years that followed because of the great economic development in China. So the building, the so-called new society, is transferred to building a more prosperous society, which did occur to a great degree in the years that followed.
How are Chinese authorities remembering the life of your mother, Isabel Crook, today?
Well, she's a much celebrated person. In fact, much too celebrated in my view. She is indeed a most admirable person. I think they were just dedicated to service in China and to build what they think is a new China still, even after 89.
Carl, your own life was clearly impacted by the decisions your parents made staying in China. Have you ever held that against Isabel Crook, your mom, or your dad?
Well, I think we did make a great scene when my parents were arrested to try and leave China, which was unsuccessful, but I wouldn't have held it against them. I think, in a way, I find my own life in China as quite adventurous myself. I went through many different circumstances in China, high and low, and I think overall I'm grateful for my Chinese legacy.
We've been speaking with Carl Crook, who's been telling us about the remarkable life of his mother, Isabel Crook, who died Sunday at the age of 107. Thank you very much for your time and for your thoughts.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.